I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. Before we get to this edition of the show, I just want to promote Wall Street Window, a website maintained by Mike Swanson that provides valuable insights on both financial markets and geopolitics. It's been around since 2003, and its slogan is "Be in the Know," and I highly recommend it as daily reading. So go on over to wallstreetwindow.com and keep yourself informed. This edition of Parallax Views is brought to you by the $10 and above tier supporters of Parallax Views on Patreon. So, with that in mind, producers credit shoutouts to Gunner, Mark, Alexander, Catherine, Tilo, Emilia, Jeff, John, Bert, Brian, Elliot, Michael, Brace, Nick,
Meresham,
Galen, Arlen, Beau,
Christopher, Michael,
Gigadelic Media, Chance, Chase, Dan,
David H, Y Kellerman, Saadad 13,
Kathleen, David,
Ava,
Bob,
The West Bank Robbery Podcast,
Jamie,
Enoch,
Gary,
Max,
Ishtofer, James, Martin, Matthew Ho,
Brian,
Nobody, Thomas, and Dano. And now on to the show.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we welcome back to the show Project Censored's Mickey Huff, a frequent guest here on Parallax Views and a longtime friend of the show, to discuss Project Censored's State of the Free Press 2024 book, covering the most censored news stories of 2024, the ones you won't be hearing about in much of the corporate press. We'll also be discussing the recent protests at Columbia University and looking back at the Kent State Massacre, which, given that there's calls to bring in the National Guard when it comes to the Columbia University protests, I think we need to remember Kent State at this time. All that and more on this edition of the show. So, with that being said, let's get right to it with Mickey Huff. Welcome back to Parallax Views. I guess we've been trying to get on. It's been a little bit hectic scheduling it, mainly on my end. We've had to reschedule a few times, but had to have him back on. Mickey Huff of Project Censored. We're going to be talking about the State of the Free Press, Project Censored's yearly look at the news that you may not have seen covered in the mainstream media. How are you doing, Mickey Huff?
I am doing well, JG. It's wonderful to be back on with you at Parallax Views. And again, I also contributed to the scheduling snafus, which I apologize for. However, here we are. And again, I'm delighted to be on with you, as always.
So, Mickey, I think my listeners at this point are very familiar with Project Censored. But maybe you could just give a brief rundown of what Project Censored is for new listeners. And also, more in depth, maybe you could talk about the theme of this year's State of the Free Press.
Sure. Project Censored is a media watchdog group. It's actually a media literacy organization that was founded in 1976 at Sonoma State University in Northern California by Carl Jensen in response to sort of the media, sort of the media milieu or sort of fracas of the late 60s and early 1970s that eventually saw Watergate and the collapse of Nixon and the rise of the Church Committee and investigation into all kind of shenanigans in the press and, you know, the media's propaganda, all while celebrating right? How the Fourth Estate was instrumental in holding Nixon accountable. And at any rate, it kind of thrust the media or journalism into the public eye into a critical way. And Carl Jensen started Project Censored as a class exercise as a means by which to investigate what the corporate or legacy or establishment media don't cover or what they miss or how long it takes for them to catch up to the alternative independent media, right? Independent journalism, often where we have people writing about things that the corporate media either ignore or distort because, well, they have different interests other than the public at heart. And the genesis of Project Censored then looked at where the Fourth Estate really played a crucial role in informing the public for meaningful civic engagement, but it challenged the notion that only the establishment media should be seen as authoritative. Jensen went back looking at the long history of muckraking independent journalism in the United States, whether it's Ida Tarbell, Lincoln Steffens, Upton Sinclair, George Seldes, Izzy Stone, et cetera, and showed that this tradition continued through the 70s, the 80s. And so Project Censored has been around for almost 50 years. We publish a book annually that looks at these underreported or censored stories from the so-called mainstream media. We call it the corporate press or establishment legacy media. But anyway, that's what Project Censored does. We also analyze junk food news, sensational news, trends. We deconstruct news abuse as propaganda. We also highlight, in addition to highlighting independent journalists that do great reporting in the public interest each year in our top 25, we also talk about media democracy in action. We look at organizations and individuals that really are in the muckraking tradition or are in a pro First Amendment free pro-free press, pro-free expression, pro-free speech vein. And that's where Project Censored sits today. We have still the annual book, weekly syndicated radio program. We have social media, critical media literacy in action series. And of course, we're involved in education, working with professors and students at campuses all over the country. So that's sort of a Cliff's Notes introduction to your audience if they didn't know who we were. You can also go to projectcensored.org and see what we do for free. Much of our material is available to public, to educators, to others for free, including curriculum, resource guides, etc. And you can also check out our new publishing arm from the past few years, The Censored Press, which we started in partnership with Seven Stories Press, our longtime partners in New York, as well as Triangle Square. And we've published about a half a dozen books now, with another half a dozen on the way. So it's been a great experience, and the project is expanding. Maybe that's not a good thing, JG, because that means that censorship is still a very real phenomenon and a very real problem in our society. I think one that more and more people have come to understand as a problem, yet not always understand how it works. A lot of folks tend to only worry about censorship when it's something that they care about or when they feel that their perspective is being squelched. And what we do at Project Censored is we try to take a bigger view about any perspectives that are being squelched, because we think that having robust debate and disagreement based on facts, evidence, and transparent sources is really what public interest journalism should be looking like. And we should be providing examples to show people how they can have these kind of difficult conversations while simultaneously providing them with information, factual information they need to be meaningfully civically engaged.
Yeah, and I would add to that, I think a lot of people, when they look at censorship, they're thinking specifically a lot of times just about government censorship, right? But, you know, the important thing about Project Censored for me is that it doesn't ignore that issue of government censorship and suppression of speech. But you also look at the ways in which, you know, corporate consolidation of media causes a number of stories to be pushed out or just thrown down the memory hole.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I'm glad you brought that up, because prior restraint is seen as that's what a lot of folks think of when they think about censorship. And others, the government doesn't interfere with information, and the government's not telling the New York Times what to print. Well, again, as political scientist Michael Parenti would say years ago, who was one of our judges years ago, he would say, well, they don't need to, because these are basically proxies. And so over the last several years, Project Censored has been really talking a lot more about what we call censorship by proxy. And to analyze then how freedom of expression is shaped by this complex interplay between government, corporate power, and interest, we developed this concept of censorship by proxy, which describes restrictions on freedom of information in three ways. One, censorship is actually undertaken more often in our country by private corporations, right, that control the media, which exceed limits on government censorship. They're not covered by the Constitution. And three, they serve both corporate and government or third party interests, right? And that's the issue with censorship by proxy, is all these tech companies or anti-social media companies, as we sometimes call them, these companies engage in various kinds of censorship on the daily, whether it's bots, algorithms, appealing to confirmation bias, shadow banning, de-ranking, delisting, and then, of course, my favorite, demonetization, demonetizing things. There's a lot of different ways that the corporate media and corporate big tech companies censor speech that would be critical of them, critical of U.S. government foreign policy, particularly given the overlap between big tech and the military industrial complex and the history of Google going back to DARPA. This stuff is all connected. Unfortunately, the corporate media, while they might look like they're reporting about a lot of details and facts about important issues on the surface, like when they're saying TikTok's a problem and we need to ban TikTok, they're never talking about how the other platforms do the same stuff. They're never talking about the long history of the military-industrial complex in big tech. They're not talking about the dangers of what just happened, the massive expansion of surveillance and, you know, ratting people out that extends from the Patriot Act over 20 years ago. So we have our work cut out for us, because censorship exists in far more pernicious and insidious ways other than just this simplistic idea of the government censoring, which we also know they do, thanks to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, thanks to other whistleblowers, thanks to the Twitter files that were very controversial because, you know, Elon Musk is a favorite whipping boy of the left, and everybody wanted to throw Matt Taibbi under the bus because he bothered to report on how the Biden administration was actively interfering in social media companies and platforms to censor certain narratives. And again, I understand that Elon Musk is problematic, but the bigger problem is big tech and media dissemination. I understand people might question the motives of someone like Matt Taibbi, but then why not question the motives of every single other journalist that isn't asking these kinds of tough questions? And they just want to pretend like it's just some Republican partisan witch hunt about coming after censors. And all they're trying to do, the Democrats say, is police disinformation. Well, we know that the Biden administration and the government was in this game because they actually had a disinformation governance board that I'm sure you've mentioned and talked about on your show before. So the government actually has been involved in curating and manipulating and trying to change narratives, which is problematic. But again, the much larger problem, and I think this, the specter that looms over all this, is this censorship by proxy issue. And we've written about it in several of our annual books, including others. I was just quoting a chapter we wrote in this wonderful new book just out, Censorship, Digital Media, and the Global Crackdown on Freedom of Expression, by our Project Censored friends, Robin Anderson, Nolan Higdon, Steve Masick. Again, great guest for your show, talking about this global crackdown of freedom of expression worldwide. And of course, we're seeing that in the United States, not just in the media and the biased propagandistic coverage around what's happening with Israel-Gaza. We're also seeing how it's manifesting on American campuses once again. We're seeing suppression of valedictorian speeches like at USC. We're seeking an absolute authoritarian crackdown at places like Columbia, silencing speech, expelling students from school. It's a very terrible trend against freedom of expression, and we all need to speak out against it, even if we don't agree with some of the messages of the protests.
So with regards to this year's annual roundup of the news and just everything Project Censored does for the State of the Free Press book, is there, I know you usually have a specific theme in mind for each year's book. What for you was the theme in this one?
You know, that's a great question. You know, Andy Roth and I, who have been editing these books for well over a decade now together, we had this idea that it kept coming up over and over again. And this goes back looking at some of the post-truth conundrum. We live in the digital era, the so-called information age, or mis and disinformation age. We could go down that rabbit hole. But we live in this era where we have all kinds of information, a sea of information, right? We're awash in a sea of information at our fingertips, but we have a paucity of understanding and dot connecting around what it might mean. And that's where critical media literacy education, civic engagement, that's where all this kind of stuff gels together. And so one of the themes we had this year, I think it's overarching, is that there's record high numbers of public distrust in American institutions, particularly the media, right? The so-called fourth estate. And so we're riffing on this idea about, well, what if journalism just disappeared? And that riffs on the concept of news deserts, mass corporate consolidation of media, the fact that we have an increasingly media illiterate society when we need even more media literacy than ever. Only 5 states in this country teach it, and they don't really mandate how, and it's usually not from a critical perspective. So our theme this year really was looking at what if journalism just disappeared, but the concept of it is really what's being lost. And then we go to show in the book that journalism hasn't disappeared. People's awareness and understanding of it is what's lacking. Independent journalists that we highlight in the top 25 reporting about like this year's stories, Forever Chemicals in Rainwater, A Global Threat to Human Health. Hiring of former CIA employees and ex-Israeli agents that blur the line between big tech and big brother. Toxic chemicals continuing to go unregulated in the U.S. It goes on and on, these stories. Leaks revealed Homeland Security plans to regulate disinformation online, i.e. censor information. These are the kind of stories that independent journalists are telling us that if the public was aware of them, it would motivate them. They would be interested in what's happening around these stories and how they affect their lives. Since the corporate media don't really report on things that really are affecting people's lives in a meaningful way, people have tuned out. People have tuned out of the horse race, team red, team blue, yo-yo nonsense. They've tuned out of the constant Taylor Swift, Travis Kelce melodrama. People have lost faith and trust in media, but that doesn't mean journalism has disappeared. It just means that the corporate media has disappeared much of it that would show the public what's wrong with our many institutions. And so this year, while we once again decry many of the shortcomings of the corporate media, which don't always fail, we also then highlight where the independent press comes in to fill in the blanks, fill in the holes, and try to tell the public, as George Selde said in the 20th century, to tell the public what's really going on. Not to go so far into the world of objectivity that we both side something, the extent to which one side has ample proof and another side has none. You know, we've seen the corporate press do that for years around the climate crisis, around now what's happening in Gaza. It leaves a really bad taste in the mouths of the public, and it also fails to report on the things people need to know in order to be civically engaged in a way that really challenges this duopolistic team red blue mentality that the corporate media has happily bought into. They have a guaranteed siloed audience that they can assure their investors, their shareholders, their advertisers, right? They'll come back. And meanwhile, this corporate legacy press has been sniping at any other alternative, whether it's the social media outlets or independent, which also have their other issues. But this is an age-old conflict that's over technological supremacy for the attention of the American public. And we're now talking about the attention economy or lack thereof attention in our society. So we address all those issues in the book this year. JG, we've got a fantastic foreword by the great Alan McLeod, the senior staff writer over at Mint Press News, that does amazing deconstruction of corporate media headlines, and again focuses on how the corporate media in this country frame things to the exclusion of so many important things and perspectives that are happening around us.
So I know this isn't necessarily in the book, but I wanted to talk with you about the Columbia protests that are happening right now. You know, I've seen all kinds of coverage of it. I am sensitive towards the issue of anti-Semitism, and I'll be fair here.
Absolutely.
You know, I think you'll find in any kind of protest, you know, one or two people that are, you know, even outside agitators that will say things that are just awful and stupid. And I have
provocative
seen videos
purpose.
Of that. Yeah.
Yes.
But yes. I mean, you know, I think the whole of these protests have been pretty peaceful. Yes. And not only that, but on the other side of this, we have people calling for bringing in the National Guard. And we also have a congressman, Tom Cotton,
telling people
to do vigilante attacks on protesters. And yet, you know, all I'm hearing about is the problems with the Colombia's protests. I find this very weird.
It's very problematic and hypocritical. And when you mention Cotton, he was calling for people to be protesters to be thrown from bridges by vigilantes. And if they glue themselves to the ground or cars or whatever, to rip off their skin. That is what Cotton said. That's a sitting representative in Congress. Calling out the National Guard should send chills up the spine of anyone with an historical memory going back to the horrible days of Kent State in 1970, when Governor Rhodes, under the direction of Nixon, called out the National Guard on the campus where they murdered 4 people and wounded 9 others. Kent State University just recently welcomed Kyle Rittenhouse, the shooter from Wisconsin, post George Floyd, to speak at the campus. Now, look, I'm all in favor of free speech. And I think that it's very important to hear different perspectives. But I also think it's important to call out this degree of, let's just say what it is, insensitivity, callousness, tone deafness. I don't think we're allowed to say that anymore. But the administrators at the university welcoming that kind of person in this kind of a divisive climate is extraordinarily stupid. I'm just going to say that out loud. The calling, the flippant calling for harming of others in protests is dangerous and stupid. And people like Cotton should be called out for it. Rittenhouse should be allowed his free speech rights, but that includes feedback. That includes having others explaining why what this person is doing is so dangerous and why it's not going to solve our country's problems, right? And what's happening with the students at places like Columbia is utterly draconian. We're seeing people mid-semester, right before finals, right before graduation, just like we saw in 1970, closing down colleges and universities, blaming the protesters for it, expelling students, kicking them out of class, disrupting their matriculation, and Columbia is doubling down by locking out all the students and faculty. It's extraordinary that this is happening, and yet there doesn't seem to be much pushback. The way the media is framing this is very much of the both sides, very much of a framing issue that the protesters are once again the problem, and they just need to go to class and get their degrees and shut up. Right. And that's antithetical to academic freedom. It's antithetical to freedom of expression protected under the First Amendment. And it's the exact opposite thing of what we need right now. We need to hear about how what's happening in the Middle East is directly connected to our lack of civic engagement. Look, a majority of Americans don't want to be sending more money and bombs to Israel to kill Palestinians. Yet we just did it again. So the Congress, many in the neoliberal professional managerial class that run the corporations of this country and academia are wildly out of touch with students, wildly out of touch with the population. So we need to be engaged. We're going to need to be in the streets. Forget about just protesting on social media. That's great for organizing and getting out messages. We're going to need to be in the streets in places like Chicago and Milwaukee this summer, and we're going to need to make the voices of the public known to those in power, and that includes the halls of power of elite media, like the New York Times, where it was just leaked that they were telling reporters not to use certain terms and phrases.
Yeah, that was reported by The Intercept. They're not even allowed to use the term occupied territories, apparently.
No, you're not allowed. It's like utterly ahistorical. I mean, Orwellian, Winston Smith would be proud at the kind of censorship at Minitrue at the New York Times. So we're living in extraordinarily censorious and biased times when the so-called paper of record gets caught once again with its pants down, right? Gray lady, pants down. Whoops. Now we're on to this story. Don't say this word. Don't call it a slaughter. Yet when the New York Times talks about Hamas killing Israelis, they use the very language that they say reporters are not permitted to use when talking about civilian deaths in Gaza. It's absolute hypocrisy, and it should be what the front page headline above the fold that the New York Times does say. Establishment hypocrisy abounds. Democracy hangs in the balance.
I want to riff a bit more, especially on my end, with regards to the protests. I'm very frustrated because I'm a person that worries a lot about moral panics. I've seen terrorism experts compare these protesters to the urban guerrillas of the 1970s, like the Red Army faction or the Weather Underground.
Oh,
and
please.
I'm sorry, but, you know, haven't seen protesters engaged in bombings or political assassinations. That's a very weird comparison to make. Not only that, but we just had John Fetterman come out and say, you know, if you would just have add in the tiki torches and this would be just like Charlottesville. And I just, I thought to myself, a 32-year-old woman was murdered at the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally in a car attack. Heather Heyer. That hasn't happened with these pro-Palestinian Gaza protesters. I don't understand this comparison. This to me is
propaganda.
Panic about protesters.
It's not a factual analogy. It's propaganda. Senator Fetterman is engaging in Zionist propaganda. That's what is happening, right? I mean, that's a completely false analogy. This is why we need critical media literacy education and critical thinking to deconstruct these kinds of messages. There is nothing anti-Semitic in calling out Fetterman's propaganda. What Fetterman is doing is making a false equivalency. This is what the corporate media do. They create both sides or false equivalencies to suggest that this is the same as that. And you clearly just pointed out one major way that these protests are worlds apart. They're worlds apart. Blocking, and again, the idea that people blocking a freeway and blocking traffic, which I know can have consequences, but the idea of saying, well, that's not the proper way to protest, that's the same thing the establishment wants to say if there's an historical MLK. Hey, Rosa Parks, you're messing things up when you're slowing down the bus. Hey, MLK, you're slowing things down with your bus boycotts. Look, this is the way you disrupt democracies to get the people in power to pay attention. The fourth estate is supposed to hold the people in power to account, not buttress them and frame their messages to further suppress the masses. And that is why we need a grassroots, bottom-up, evolutionary revolutionary movement that puts media freedom at the forefront, that champions diversity of perspective and honors academic freedom and freedom of expression from the campuses to the public square to the media, right? And I think that I think JG, what you just pointed out should be on the editorial pages of the New York Times if they weren't corrupt and they weren't complicit in biased framing of what's happening. But they are not objective. They are not able to distance themselves from the views of their owners and paymasters and their friends in the military-industrial complex arena. And therefore, they will continue to propound obfuscatory messages to either appeal to the audiences with confirmation bias or otherwise bewilder the public.
And the other thing, I want to go back real quick to these calls that we're seeing. I just saw John Podhoretz, a journalist today, saying, oh, we need to bring in the National Guard. And if you don't want to see the National Guard brought in, you're an anti-Semite. And I'm just thinking to myself, you know, it's literally, we're a week or two away from the anniversary of the Kent State Massacre.
Yes, we are, which I've written about at length before.
Well, I wanted you to talk about that. Have we not learned any lessons in these intervening decades? I mean, calling in the National Guard, it would harm every student there, potentially. It could lead to violence for Jewish and non-Jewish students.
That's what they're not seeing. They think that it's only, and look, I love how they talk about these people protesting. Instead of saying that they're protesting the genocide in Gaza, they call them anti-Semitic protesters. So it's framing, right? It's all about framing in media. Look, Laurel Krauss, whose sister was murdered at Kent State May 4th, 1970. Kent State Truth Tribunal is a site that your listeners can check out. We did a 50th anniversary special about it 4 years ago. We're coming up on the 54th anniversary or commemoration. It's certainly not something to be celebrated. But when the guard was called in, you're right, it created a climate of indiscriminate and wanton military-grade violence on a civilian population, principally young people. And even though there was mayhem at Kent State and a burning of the ROTC building, much of this was later found out to be potentially COINTELPRO provocation. And there was an FBI informant involved and at Kent State in late April, early May 1970. His name was Terry Norman. And we've talked about how Stuart Allen, a late forensics analyst, showed that there were gunshots fired, auditory records of it before the guard shot. It played into the FBI narrative that the guard was being attacked. It wasn't true. It's likely argued that Terry Norman's gun was fired when the protesters were surrounding him as a provocateur. His gun was later shown to have been fired and confiscated, and he was allowed to leave. Now, I know some people in the audience might be saying, that sounds like a conspiracy theory. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's analysis of what we know about what happened there that day that I.F. Stone, the great muckraking journalist, later wrote about, and others, that this was all part of a COINTEL program, counterintelligence program of the Nixon administration to quell protests on campuses. Because he was getting caught in a great conundrum of trying to Vietnamize the war while simultaneously hypocritically expanding it. And he wasn't even expanding it to Laos and Cambodia in a way that hadn't been done before. He was just announcing it publicly that they were going to keep doing it. Anyway, not to go down the historiographic rabbit hole there, this matters because this is how the guard and how the militarization against protest backfires in big ways. By calling in the guard, it put everyone in that community at risk, like you suggested. And now we find out that there was chicanery, there was other things going on. In fact, some of the people shot and killed were not even students, right? This is extraordinary. We wrote 10 years ago, Laurel and I, about this as it applied to the Occupy Wall Street movement, because we saw a spate of infiltration, provocateurs, whatever, from Zuccotti Park to Oakland, California. We saw instance after instance of exactly this kind of behavior and a routine militarization of police to crack skulls, arrest, detain, ask questions, and look at people's rights later. That is not the proper way to address the right of assembly and the right of protest on any side of a question or an issue. And again, where we're heading with this right now, JG, to me is very troubling based on that history. And look, never mind Jackson State that gets totally memory holed, because the police shooting black people is far more normalized in American history, whether it's 1970 or 2023 or 4. And so I think that your line of inquiry here is a very important one, and especially coming up on such an important historical milestone, I think people should be really mindful of past as prologue. And what can we learn from the past so we don't repeat such horribly tragic mistakes where people's lives are taken here, all for protesting the fact that our tax money and weaponry is being wantonly used to take the lives of innocent people thousands of miles away.
And another thing before we move on is I find it very concerning that we're now getting to this point again. It's happened with Occupy before, where, you know, people bring up things like, oh, they're blocking this bridge and it's blocking traffic. And as you said, I get that there's problems with that. However, you know, we're seeing protesters be described as a mob.
Yeah.
But what I'm seeing is another mob forming.
Yes.
It's a mob that's saying protest bad. Don't do protesting. There's a silencing that I think goes on. And I think protest is necessary to any functioning democracy. And I mean, I feel like that is really being ignored right now. And to go back to it again, we just had a congressman say that, you know, we need to throw people off bridges if they're protesting. I mean, I feel like I'm in bizarro world right now when this isn't that. That should be the focus right now. We're being told that protest bad, and we're seeing That's sort of, in my view, mob mobilization against protesting. It's ridiculous. Yeah.
I agree with you 100%. And I think we're going to see how that plays out this summer, in particular, in Chicago and Milwaukee, other way around, Milwaukee and Chicago chronologically for both Republican and Democratic conventions. Whereas we've seen in the past from the Bush years on, you know, not going just to get out of the Nixon realm for a minute and the Reagan realm, and let's go to the post 9/11 era. It was commonplace to see suppression of protests and militarization against protesters. And again, we just now saw the Congress passing, you know, more power for the president, more power for the U.S. government to get people to squeal on each other, to get people to spy on each other. And this is all around creating a climate of fear, or as you mentioned earlier, a moral panic around the danger of protests, right? That all protests are inherently violent, that all protests are somehow coming only from the left and the rabble of the progressive side of the equation, where we rarely see violence meted out by the people protesting. Contrast that on the right, where we have example after example of vigilante so-called justice, with people taking arms into their and shooting people like Kyle Rittenhouse and others. Again, it's just a false equivalency, and it's something that should be called out. That's not to say that we can't have conservative or right-wing protests against things, but they should not be involving violence, and they shouldn't involve calls for violence, and incited speech is not protected speech. So let's remember, we already have rules and guidelines on the books and courts, which are stacked against the favor of those who'd like to protest. And that's another problem. Just like we have regulatory corporate capture of our many regulatory agencies, from the EPA to the FCC. But look, a right of assembly and expression is the core of our democratic values and principles, along with the Fourth Estate and the free press. And all of those rights and the institutions that are available to protect them are either corrupted or under assault. And we need the independent press now to be calling that out clearly, soberly, not in an alarmist way, but in a matter-of-fact way, that the kind of things that people like John Fetterman are saying are just not factually accurate, the kind of things that Representative Cotton are saying are well beneath the dignity of the office he holds, which is a privilege to represent the public. And most of the people in that body have long forgotten whom they serve.
And I was also going to say, I mean, I think this kind of anti-protest talk, it also preps the public for accepting, you know, not just, you know, Tom Cotton's crazy ideas for vigilante justice, but, you know, I remember when I was in Pittsburgh for the G20 that was held, yes, in Pittsburgh a number of years ago. I mean, tear gas was used on protesters. There was the LRAD sound cannons used. And when people are prepped to just say, oh, protesters bad, they accept all this kind of, you know, technology and
force.
Police crackdown use.
Yeah.
Use of force against protesters that is way over the line.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? Many of our country's police chiefs and people involved in these teams are either quasi-military in background, hence the whole 1033 thing, the whole like militarization of local police forces with Pentagon getting rid of their old toys. And then it's also the problem that we've written about a Project Censor for years, how a lot of these officers go abroad and are trained in Israel by the Israeli Defense Forces on how to crack down on civilians, how to create a police state. Well, the IDF are experts at that, at doing it in occupied Palestine, right? So we're seeing a direct connection between what's happening in Gaza and what's happening in American cities with the approach to who is protesting and how the use of force is rolled out, right? And it's incredible that, as you've mentioned, that this bias of protesters bad and the use of force good, I'm afraid that makes for a very, very dangerous cocktail.
Just a few more things here, and then I'll let you go. I saw that there was dedication in the latest Project Censored State of the Free Press for Daniel Ellsberg. Do you want to talk about Dan briefly here?
Dan Ellsberg, of course, just a towering, iconic figure dedicated to telling the truth, to supporting whistleblowers from Chelsea Manning to Thomas Drake, Edward Snowden, John Kuryakow, and of course, WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. I don't think Ellsberg's importance and significance in U.S. history can be overstated. The Nixon administration saw him as, quote, the most dangerous man in America, which obviously would be a badge of honor to anyone who supports press freedom and the public's right to know. Dan was a trooper till the end. He gave some of his last interviews to a colleague and friend of ours, Kevin Gostola. We had the great honor of publishing his book, Guilty of Journalism, on the political case of Julian Assange. Ellsberg was a huge supporter of Gostola and Assange. And again, we wanted to honor Ellsberg's work. Over 10 years ago, he wrote something specifically for us on civic engagement and particularly what he called civil courage. He talked about how in our country we talk about valor and courage associated with patriotism, but that it was often associated militaristically through veterans and wars. And Ellsberg said, you know, I worked for the RAND Corporation and did intel for the Pentagon, and I saw the lies and what was happening, and my conscience said that I needed to expose the lies and the deception and the lot because so many lives were being destroyed, not just American lives, but lives across the world, including in Vietnam, 3 million. And Ellsberg, you know, did what he thought was right and was punished for it. And they tried to go after him for it. But he talked about the civil courage is when a whistleblower, somebody who's inside and knows the things that are happening, that they decide to put aside their own interest and their own safety, and they speak out because of they so value the integrity of our systems and our institutions, and they demand that we do better. That kind of civil courage, Ellsberg argued, is really underappreciated in our society. And whistleblowers are often seen as people that are trying to take advantage of something, or they're trying to attract attention, or they're narcissistic, or they have other agendas. Right. And look, while some of those things can be true in various cases, as a whole, the protected role of whistleblower, which is protected by Congress, is that of one who exemplifies civil courage, the degree to which they've put bigger ideas and concepts as in front of their own safety and their own career stability. And Ellsberg exemplified that in every way. And so we were honored to have worked with him and known him. And so this year's book was dedicated to him and his legacy. And of course, JG, you know, we've lost a number of people even this year and late last year, including Terry Anderson, who was held as a hostage for 6 years. The great John Pilger passed late last year, as did Christina Borgeson, and also the great critical media literacy activist John Boyer. So it's we're losing a lot of folks that have been veterans of the civil courage movement and the media freedom and media reform movement. And it's important to recognize those contributions because we all build on the work of those people who came before us.
So I've avoided asking you about any individual stories from the State of the Free Press book, because I know I think usually we get into the more broad approach in these conversations.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I did want to say that the story that really stuck out to me was the Forever Chemicals issues that you cover, I think, in two different parts of the book. I mean, there's a few stories on toxic chemicals and whatnot in our water supply, et cetera. Could you just speak to that issue and how important it is that, you know, we shine a light on it?
Absolutely. And, you know, last year, the top story was on how the fossil fuel industry was subsidized to the tune of $11 million a minute. That's now up to $13 million. And of course, fossil fuel burning in the atmosphere relates to the climate crisis. Forever Chemicals in rainwater is something that's obviously connected to all these kinds of things spewing into the atmosphere, and in particular, what are called PFAS or PFAS, right, which is polyfluoroalkyl substances. This story this year specifically from Insider came from research at North Central College in outside of Chicago, and they talked about how environmental scientists have found hazardous levels of manufactured chemicals in rainwater, leading to the dramatic conclusion that rainwater itself is, quote, no longer safe to drink anywhere on Earth. Maybe this is why the tech bros are going to Mars or the moon. But this has been coming for a long time. And what they go on to say, a report from the Environmental Science and Technology Journal, scientists concluded, quote, in many areas inhabited by humans, PFAS contamination levels in rainwater, surface water, and soil, quote, often greatly exceed the strictest international guidelines for acceptable levels of these chemicals and toxins in our water. There you have it. Water is the basis of life on Earth. And we have sullied it everywhere, the degree to which not just people in Flint are suffering, but people all over the world. Not only are we suffering from the idiocy of lead and other contaminants in urban areas in this country, the wealthiest country in the world, you know, echoing the tragedies of Rome, while we have our own Neros fiddling while things are burning. But we've sullied things enough that we've wrecked it for most of the planet. And again, as you said earlier, I don't subscribe to the invocation of moral panics in a way that creates chaos and more authoritarian control. But I think we can create a sense of awareness about the current degree to which we've seriously altered the climate of the planet. A degree to which, harnessing George Carlin, we're making it uninhabitable for us and other living things. This is what we're getting at here. As Carlin quipped, the Earth will eventually, you know, pop us off and there'll be less of us, fewer of us. But that's tragic because we're taking ourselves out along with a whole raft of other amazing living things. We've only got one planet. I don't mean to be trite, but at some point, just like you were flabbergasted earlier about some of the remarkable things that fly out of people's mouths, I'm flabbergasted equally by how people just kind of harumph at it's the hottest year on record every year. How crazy weather events are the norm. The storm of the century comes every year. I don't know when people are going to wake up to this, JG, but I surmise that it's only going to be just before the metaphorical asteroid hits the Earth.
Very last thing I wanted to touch upon here was, can you talk about the importance of when you're doing a book like The State of the Free Press to have a sort of eclectic variety of contributors? Because I think sometimes people don't realize, I don't necessarily agree with, say, Matt Taibbi on everything, or right, Alan McLeod I don't agree with on some issues. But,
sure,
you know, you have an eclectic variety of voices in there, ranging from an Alan McLeod to I saw Jen Senko from the documentary The Brainwashing of My Dad was in there. Yep. I saw Maximilian Alvarez, the great pro-labor journalist, is in there. So I think you have a very eclectic variety of voices. And I think sometimes when people are covering Project Censored, I've seen it covered in other outlets, they don't really hone in on the fact that you guys do have an eclectic variety of contributors. And I think they want to paint Project Censored one way, and it's not always a very accurate way.
Thank you for that. And just so everybody knows the disclaimer, I did not suggest or pay JG to say that. I got to tell you, so often the work we do with the project is wildly misrepresented. And as you pointed out quite adroitly, we have many different voices. We've had people from SP, the Society of Professional Journalists, Mint Press. We've had Abby Martin, from Empire Files. We've had Cheryl Atkison, right, from Sinclair Broadcasting, write the foreword to one of our books, right? We're troubled about censorship wherever it occurs, and we champion investigative journalism anywhere it exists, as long as it's factual, transparent, and in the public interest. Look, I, like you, I don't agree with everything that's in the book. I don't even agree with how all the stories are or how they're ranked all the time. But the benefit of working with a pool of 20-some judges, 10 to 20 faculty members, 200 students, you know, a staff of 8 to 10 people, is that we have to compromise and we have to keep our eyes on the prize. What are the most significant and important stories? It's not what are Mickey and Andy's favorite things. And it's not
a bit more democratic, you could say.
Wow. Yeah, you could suggest that it's democracy in action, as messy as it is, right? And I agree. You know, we don't always have to agree with these people. And look, like, for example, Jen Sanko is a fabulous filmmaker. But I'd love to see somebody make the same movie about MSNBC and Rachel Maddow and Russiagate, you know. But see, just because I also think that that should happen doesn't mean I don't appreciate the value of what Sanko and the film do, right? In other words, it's both and. It's not either or. And a lot of people want to litmus test us just like they litmus test anybody else according to their confirmation bias. If they come to us and hear something they don't like, then we're the ones that are biased, or we're the conspiracy theorists, or we're the ones that are sucking up the tech bros, which is totally absurd. I mean, if you take a look at the cover of this year's book, Anson Stevens Bolin, the great artist that does the covers for our book, you'll see Rupert Murdoch burning a Tucker Carlson bill from all the Dominion money they lost. You'll see none other than Bill Gates, right? The big tech nightmare in media, who funds all kinds of media around the world. And then you see, of course, Elon Musk at Tesla, now X, and the bird barfing up the X. You know, again, a little homage to Ani DiFranco. The stars are going out and the stripes are getting bent, right? Violence covering propaganda. We're very critical of the big tech sector. We're very critical of these groups. So the idea that somehow, because we, you know, supported some of the work of Matt Taibbi, means we're like in bed with Elon Musk is as intellectually vapid and fatuous as people saying we're pro-Putin or Russia because we think the whole enterprise in Ukraine has been a corrupt disaster. Right? I mean, the nuance is totally lost in rank partisanship and confirmation bias fervor. And what we try to do is we try to cut through that. And because that fog is so thick, we try to cut through it from any angle we can. And that's why we have such an eclectic list of stories, an eclectic list of outlets and journalists, and why we even laud the corporate media when they do a good job reporting in the public interest. Because sometimes they do. So I think that's why Project Censored can be a lightning rod for people, is because on one level, you can always find something we did or that I said or whatever, all the people that we network with, you can always find something that you don't like. And if you want to use that as a sort of halo horn effect to judge everything else we do, then that problem's with you, not with us. But we would like to invite people to please take a good look at the vast array of things that we do and we cover, and understand that our prime objective is to educate the public around critical media literacy values, to champion a free and independent press in the public interest, and to also express to people that it's important to have meaningful civic engagement and discourse and debate that doesn't destroy our institutions, but builds them up. And we wrote all about that in Let's Agree to Disagree with Nolan Higdon. And I wrote about it in United States of Distraction, our City Lights book from 5 years ago, that's ever more relevant today. But I think, JG, that a lot of folks don't take the time to see that our media ecosystem is vast, and it is actually really pretty diverse. And there's a lot of good and bad across the spectrum. And I think it takes work for organizations and people not only to ferret it out, but to confidently share it in ways where we're building toward what we think is a freer and more independent press in the public interest.
Well, hey, Mickey E. Huff, I think that's a great way to wrap. Anything else you want to say in closing? How can my listeners keep up with all that Project Censored is doing?
Well, I want to thank you so much for what you do at Parallax Views. So many of the guests and topics you cover are exactly what the corporate media, I wish, would shine a light on and focus on. You can follow our work at projectcensored.org. We have a really weekly radio show, 14 years now on Pacifica, over 50 stations, called The Project Censored Show. We're on social media in the belly of the beast, doing critical media literacy in action video series, where we're actually talking about social media and how it works and doesn't work, deconstructing it in ways that allow people to be more aware of the pitfalls and censorship and things that happen on social media outlets. We also have the publishing arm, as I mentioned earlier, at thecensoredpress.org. If you're an educator, a teacher, and you want to learn more about our book, The Media and Me, one of the only critical media literacy books written for young people, please contact me at mickey@projectcensored.org. We've donated over 1,000 books to schools and libraries across the country in furtherance of media literacy education. We're proud partners with the National Coalition Against Censorship and part of the Banned Book Week Coalition. And we try to fight censorship in its many guises in maintenance of a true, vibrant, democratic republic. Projectcensored.org. Check us out. We'd love to hear from you. And JG, once again, thanks for everything that you're doing. Anything we can do to further boost your signal, we would love to do it, because I really appreciate the deeper conversations and the historically contextual conversations you have with your many interesting guests. I'm honored to be one of many.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Mickey Huff. As always, if you appreciate the work here I do at Parallax Views, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. One more time, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. I should be posting up some bonus content later this week, maybe running through the news, more commentary on the goings-on at Columbia University, and other topics that I think need to be covered right now. And then next month, we'll be back on Patreon with the Parallax Vlog with C. Derek Varn. But I will be releasing some bonus content this week to make up for the fact that the Parallax Vlog isn't happening this month. We're, you know, getting back to it next month. So with that in mind, please support me at patreon.com/parallaxviews. It is you, the listener, that makes this show possible. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.